Dad! Obi yelled. The title struck Obi-Wan as curious, given that this was a clone and not a natural son. Was there a connection here? A real one? Had Jango wanted the exact replica not for any professional gain, but simply because he had wanted a son?
Dad!
The boy shouted again.
Ton Wee's here!
Jango Fett walked in, dressed in simple shirt and trousers. Obi-Wan recognized him immediately, though he was many years older than the oldest clone, his face scarred and pitted and unshaven. His body had thickened with age, but he was still physically imposing, much like many of the old gutter dwellers Obi-Wan encountered in far-flung places. A few extra pounds, sure, but those covered muscles hardened by years of tough living. Tattoos crossed both of Jango's muscular forearms, of a strange design that Obi-Wan did not recognize. As he glanced up, he recognized the clear suspicion with which Jango was eyeing him. The man was on edge here, dangerously so, Obi-Wan understood.
Welcome back, Jango, Ton Wee remarked. Was your trip productive?
Obi-Wan studied the bounty hunter intensely. Back from where? But Jango was a professional, and his expression revealed not the slightest tick or wince. Fairly, the man casually offered. He continued to size up Obi-Wan as he spoke, his eyes narrowing in an almost open threat.
This is Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ton Wee said, her tone lighter, obviously an attempt to relieve some of the palpable tension. He's come to check on our progress.
That right. If Jango cared, his tone didn't show it.
Your clones are very impressive, Obi-Wan said. You must be very proud.
I'm just a simple man trying to make my way in the universe, Master Jedi. Aren't we all? Obi-Wan finally broke eye contact with Jango as he spoke, scanning the room, looking for clues. He focused on the half-open door through which Jango had appeared, and thought he saw pieces of body armor in there, battered and stained, much like that worn by a rocket man after delivering a toxic dart into the changeling Zam Wessel. And he saw a curving bluish line, like the goggle and breather area of the helmet he had seen back on Coruscant. Before he could scrutinize the sight any more closely, though, Jango walked in front of him, pointedly blocking his view.
"Ever make your way as far into the interior as Coruscant?" Obi-Wan asked, rather bluntly.
"Once or twice."
"Recently?"
Again, the bounty hunter's gaze became obviously suspicious. "Possibly."
"Then you must know Master Sifo Dyas," Obi-Wan remarked, not out of any logical follow-up reasoning, but simply to gauge the man's reaction.
There was none, nor did Jango Fett move a centimeter out of Obi-Wan's line of sight. And when the Jedi tried to subtly alter his angle to gain a view, Jango said, in a coded language,
"Boba, close the door."
Not until that bedroom door shut did Jango Fett move to the side, and then it seemed to Obi-Wan as if the man was stalking him.
"Master who?" Jango asked.
"Sifo Dyas. Isn't he the one who hired you for this job?"
"Never heard of him," Jango replied, and if there was a lie in his words, Obi-Wan could not detect it.
"Really?"
"I was recruited by a man called Tyrannus on one of the moons of Bogdan," Jango explained, and again it seemed to Obi-Wan as if he was speaking truthfully.
"Curious," Obi-Wan muttered.
He glanced down, surprised and at a loss as to what all of this might mean.
"Do you like your army?" Jango Fett asked him.
"I look forward to seeing them in action," the Jedi replied.
Jango continued to stare at him, to try to see his intent behind his words, Obi-Wan knew. And then, as if it hardly mattered, the bounty hunter gave a toothy smile.
"They'll do their job well, I'll guarantee that."
"Like their source."
Jango Fett continued to smile.
"Thanks for your time, Jango,"
Obi-Wan said against that uncompromising stare. Then he turned to Ton Wee and started for the door.
"Always a pleasure to meet a Jedi," came the reply.
It was heavy with double meaning, almost like a veiled threat. But Obi-Wan wasn't about to call him on it. Jango Fett was clearly a dangerous man, streetwise and cunning, and likely better than most with any weapon handy. Before he pushed things any further, Obi-Wan realized that he should relay all that he had learned thus far back to Coruscant and the Jedi Council. This discovery of a clone army was nothing short of amazing, and more than a little unsettling, and none of it made much sense. And was Jango the rocket man Obi-Wan had seen in Coruscant that night when Padme Amidala had been attacked? Obi-Wan's gut told him that Jango was. But how did that jibe with the man also being the host for a clone army supposedly commissioned by a former Jedi Master? With Tonwi beside him, the Jedi left the apartment, and the door slid closed behind him. Obi-Wan paused and focused his senses back, even reaching out with the Force. The door lock quietly secured. "It was his starfighter, wasn't it, Dad?" Boba Fett asked. "He's a Jedi Knight, so he can use the R4P. Jango gave his son an absent nod. "I knew it!" Boba squealed. But then Jango abruptly stole the moment. Jango fixed Boba with a no-nonsense look that the young boy had learned well not to ignore. "What is it, Dad?" "Pack your things. We're leaving." Boba started to reply, but, "Now," the bounty hunter said, and Boba practically tripped over himself, scrambling for his bedroom. Jango Fett shook his head. He didn't need this aggravation. Not at this time. Not for the first time, the bounty hunter questioned his decision to take the contract against Padme Amidala. He had been surprised when the Trade Federation had approached him with the offer. They had been adamant, explaining only that the death of the senator was critical to securing necessary allies, and they had made an offer too lucrative for Jango to refuse, one that would set him and Boba up forever on a planet of their choosing. Little had Jango known, though, that taking the contract on Senator Amidala would put him in the crosshairs of the Jedi Knights. He looked across the way to Boba. That was not a place he wanted to be at this time. Not at all. Chapter 17. Padme awoke suddenly, her senses immediately tuning into her surroundings. Something was wrong, she knew instinctively, and she jumped up, scrambling about out of fear that another of those centipede creatures was upon her. But her room was quiet, with nothing out of place. Something had awakened her, but not something in here. "No!" came a cry from the adjoining bedroom, where Anakin was sleeping. "No! Mom! No, don't!" Padme slipped out of bed and ran to the door, not even bothering to grab a robe, not even caring or noticing that she was wearing a small silken shift. At the door, she paused and listened. Hearing cries from within, followed by more jumbled yelling, she realized that there was no immediate danger, that this was another of Anakin's nightmares, like the one that had gripped him on the shuttle ride to Naboo. She opened the door and looked in on him. He was thrashing about on the bed, yelling, "Mom!" repeatedly. Unsure, Padme started in. But then Anakin calmed and rolled back over. The dream, the vision, apparently passed. Then Padme did become aware of her revealing dress. She moved back through the door, shutting it gently, then waited for a long while. When she heard no further screaming or tossing, she went back to her bed. She lay awake in the dark for a long, long while, thinking of Anakin, thinking that she wanted to be in there beside him, holding him, helping him through his troubled dreams. She tried to dismiss the notion. They had already covered this dangerous ground and had come to an understanding of what must be. And that agreement did not include her climbing into bed beside Anakin. The next morning, she found him on the east balcony of the lodge, overlooking the lake in the budding sunrise. He was standing by the balustrade, so deep in thought that he did not notice her approach. She moved up slowly, not wanting to disturb him, for as she neared, she realized that he was doing more than thinking here, that he was actually deep in meditation. Recognizing this as a private time for Anakin, she turned and started away, as quietly as she could.
"Don't go," Anakin said to her.
"I don't want to disturb you," she told him, surprised.
"Your presence is soothing."
Padme considered those words for a bit, taking pleasure in hearing them, then scolding herself for taking that pleasure. But still, as she stood there looking upon him, his face now serene, she couldn't deny the attraction. He seemed to her like a young hero, a budding Jedi, and she had no doubt that he would be among the greatest that great order had ever known. And at the same time, he seemed to her to be the same little kid she had known during the war with the Trade Federation, inquisitive and impetuous, aggravating and charming all at once.
"You had a nightmare again last night," she said quietly, when Anakin at last opened his blue eyes.
"Jedi don't have nightmares," came the defiant reply.
"I heard you," Padme was quick to answer.
Anakin turned to regard her. There was no compromise in her expression. She knew perfectly well that his claim was ludicrous, and she let him know that she knew it.
"I saw my mother," he admitted, lowering his gaze. "I saw her as clearly as I see you now.
She is suffering, Padme. They're killing her. She's in pain."
"Who?" Padme asked, moving toward him, putting a hand on his shoulder.
When she looked at him more closely, she noted a determination so solid that it took her by surprise.
"I know I'm disobeying my mandate to protect you," Anakin tried to explain. "I know I'll be punished and possibly thrown out of the Jedi Order, but I have to go."
"Go?"
"I have to help her."
"I'm sorry, Padme," he said.
She saw from his expression that he meant it, that leaving her was the last thing he ever wanted to do.
"I don't have a choice."
"Of course you don't. Not if you believe that your mother is in trouble." Anakin gave her an appreciative nod.
"I'll go with you," she decided.
Anakin's eyes widened. He started to reply, ready to argue, but Padme's smile held his words in check.
"That way, you can continue to protect me," she reasoned.
Somehow she made it sound perfectly logical. "And you won't be disobeying your mandate."
"I don't think this is what the Jedi Council had in mind. I fear that I'm walking into danger, and to take you with me."
"Walking into danger," Padme echoed, and she laughed aloud.
"A place I've never been before." Anakin stared at her, hardly believing what he was hearing. He couldn't resist, though, and his smile, too, began to widen. For some reason he did not quite understand, the Padawan found a good measure of justification in his abandoning the letter of his orders now that Padme was in on, and agreeing with, the plan. Neither Padme nor Anakin could miss the stark contrast when they took her sleek starship out of hyperspace and saw the brown planet of Tatooine looming before them. How different it was from Naboo, a place of green grasses and deep blue water, with cloud patterns swirling all across it. Tatooine was just a ball of brown, hanging in space, as barren as Naboo was alive. "Home again to go to rest," Anakin recited, a common children's rhyme. "By hearth and heart, house and nest," Padme added. Anakin looked over at her, pleasantly surprised.
"You know it."
"Doesn't everyone?"
"I don't know," Anakin said. "I mean, I wasn't sure if anyone else. I thought it was a rhyme my mother made up for me."
"Oh, I'm sorry," Padme said. "Maybe she did. Maybe hers was different than the one my mother used to tell me." Anakin shook his head doubtfully, but he wasn't bothered by the possibility. In a strange way, he was glad that Padme knew the rhyme, glad that it was a common gift from mothers to their children, and glad especially that he and Padme had yet another thing in common. "They haven't signaled any coordinates yet," she noted.
They probably won't unless we ask, Anakin replied. Things aren't very strict here, usually. Just find a place and park it, then hope no one steals it while you go about your business.
As lovely as I remember it.
Anakin looked at her and nodded.
How different things were now than that decade before when Padme had been forced to land on Tatooine with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon in order to effect repairs on their ship. He tried to manage a smile, but the edge of his nervousness kept it from appearing genuine. Too many disturbing thoughts assaulted him. Was his mother all right? Was his dream a premonition of what was to come, or a replay of something that had already happened? He brought the ship down fast, breaking through the atmosphere and soaring across the sky. Mos Espa, he explained, when the skyscape of the city came into sight against the horizon. He went in hard, and some protests did squeal over the comlink. But Anakin knew his way around this place as surely as if he had never left. He did a flyby over the edge of the city, then put the starship down in a large landing bay amid a jumble of vessels of all merchant and mercenary classes.
"Yous can't just drop in uninvited,"
barked the dock officer, a stout creature with a piggish face and spikes running down the length of his back and tail.
"It's a good thing you invited us then," Anakin said calmly, with a slight wave of his hand.
"Yes, it's a good thing I invited you then," the officer happily replied.
And Anakin and Padme walked past, with Padme giggling.
"Anakin, you're bad," Padme said as they exited onto the dusty street.
"It's not like there are dozens of ships lined up to fill the bay," Anakin replied, feeling pretty good about himself and the ease with which he had force-convinced the piggish officer. He waved down a floating rickshaw pulled by an ESPSA droid, a short and thin creature with a wheel where its leg should have been. Anakin gave it the address and off it went, pulling them behind in the floating rickshaw, charging along the streets of Mos Espa, expertly zigging and zagging to avoid the heavy traffic, and blasting forth a shrill sound whenever someone didn't get out of the way.
"Do you think he was involved?" Padme asked Anakin.
"Watto?"
"Yes, that was his name, right, your former master?"
"If Watto has hurt my mother in any way, I will pluck his wings from his back," he promised, meaning every word. He wasn't sure how he would feel about seeing the slaver, even if Watto had nothing to do with bringing any harm to Shmi. Watto had treated him better than most in Mos Espa treated their slaves, and hadn't beaten him too often. But still, it hung in Anakin's thoughts that Watto had not let Shmi go with him when Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon had bought out his slave debt. Anakin understood that he was probably just deflecting some of his own guilt about leaving his mother with Watto, who was a businessman after all.
"Here, Espasa," Anakin said to the droid, and the rickshaw glided to a stop in front of a shop, all too familiar to Anakin Skywalker. There, sitting on a stool near the door, fiddling with an electronic driver on a broken piece of equipment that looked like a droid component, was a rounded, winged Toydarian with a long snout. A black round hat adorned his head, and a small vest was pulled as far as it would go about his girth. Anakin recognized him immediately. He paused for so long in just staring at Watto that Padme got out before him and held her hand to help him.
"Wait here," she instructed the droid. "Please."
"Not Chuba the Wanga, the Wanga!"
Watto yelled at the broken component, and at a trio of pit droids who were scrambling all about trying to help.
"Hatties," Anakin explained to Padme.
"No, not that one, that one," she replied. And at Anakin's expression of surprise that she knew the strange language, she added, "You think it's easy being the queen?"
Anakin shook his head and looked back to Watto, then glanced at Padme once or twice as they neared.
"Chut-chut, Watto," he greeted.
"Kibuda,"
came the surprised response.
"Denova, chut-chut," Anakin reiterated, his words barely audible above the clamoring pit droids.
"Go, Anabopa,"
Watto yelled at the trio, and on his command, they immediately shut down and snapped back into their storage position.
"Dingmi Chasahopa," Anakin offered, taking the piece of the broken droid from Watto and manipulating it expertly. Watto watched him for a moment, his bug-like eyes growing even larger in surprise.
"Kibuda,"
he asked.
Your band Pihota! No, we can make Condorta! Kinshasa to Jedi! No Bathatutu!
He doesn't know you, Padme whispered to Anakin, trying to hold back her laughter at Watto's last statement, which translated to, whatever it is, I didn't do it. Mi Bosca di Shmi Skywalker, Anakin bluntly stated. Watto's eyes narrowed suspiciously. Who would be looking for his old slave? The Toydarian's gaze went from Anakin to Padme, then back to Anakin.
Annie,
he asked in basic.
Little Annie! Nah!
Anakin's answer came with a deft twist of his hands, and the sound of the little piece of equipment whirring to life. Smiling widely, he handed it back to Watto. There weren't many around who could work such magic on broken droid parts.
You are Annie!
The Toydarian cried.
It is you!
His wings started beating furiously, lifting him from the stool to hover in the air.
You're sure sprouted.
Hello, Watto.
Yo!
The Toydarian cried.
A Jedi? What do you know? Hey, maybe you could help me with some deadbeats who owe me a little money.
My mother, Anakin prompted.
Ah, yeah, Shmi. She's not mine no more. I sold her.
Sold her? Anakin felt Padme squeeze his forearm.
Years ago. Sorry, Annie, but you know, business is a business. Sold it to a moisture farmer named Lars. At least I think it was Lars. Believe it or not, I heard he freed her and married her. Can you beat that?
Anakin just shook his head, trying hard to digest it all. Do you know where they are?
Long way from here. Someplace over on the other side of Mos Eisley, I think.
Could you narrow it down? Watto thought about it for a moment, then just shrugged. I'd like to know, Anakin said, his tone and expression grim and determined, even threatening. The way Watto's features seemed to tighten showed that he got the hint that Anakin wasn't fooling around.
Yeah, sure,
he said.
Absolutely. Let's go look at my records.
The three went into the shop, and seeing the place brought memories swirling back to Anakin. How many hours, years he had toiled in here, fixing everything Watto threw his way. And out back, where he had put all the spare parts he could find so that he could build a pod racer. Not all of the memories were bad, he had to admit, but the good ones did not overcome the reality that he had been a slave. Watto's slave. Fortunately for Watto, his records gave a location for the moisture farm of one Cleeg Lars.
Stay a while, Annie,
the Toydarian offered after sharing the information on Shmi's new owner. Or was it her husband? Without a word, Anakin turned about and walked away. This was the last time he would look at Watto and the shop, he decided. Unless, of course, he found out that Watto was lying to him about Shmi's fate, or that Watto had somehow hurt his mother. Back to the lot, Espasa, he said to the droid, as he and Padme rushed back to the rickshaw. Fast!
Hey, you sure I can get you something to drink?
Watto called to them from the door of his shop. But they were already rushing away, kicking up dust in their wake.
Annie the Jedi,
Watto remarked, and he waved both his hands dismissively at the departing rickshaw.
What do you know?
Anakin took the starship out even more furiously than he had brought it in, blasting away from the lot and nearly colliding with a small freighter as it maneuvered to put down. Calls of protest came into him from Mos Espa control, but he just switched off the comm and zoomed off across the city. Soon after, they passed over the race grounds, where the younger Anakin had often raced in his pods, but he barely glanced at it as he put the ship out straight over the desert, heading for Mos Eisley. When that port came into view, he veered to the north and crossed past it, moving higher in the sky. They spotted one moisture farm, then another, and then the third, almost in a direct line from the city. That one, Padme said. Anakin nodded grimly, and brought the ship down on a bluff overlooking the homestead.
I'm really going to see her again, he breathed, shutting down the engines. Padme squeezed his arm and offered him a comforting smile. You don't know what it's like to leave your mother like that, he said. I leave my family all the time, she replied. But you're right. It's not the same. I can't imagine what it's like to be a slave, Anakin. It's worse to know that your mother is one. Padme nodded, conceding the point. Stay with the ship, R2, she instructed the droid, who beeped in reply. The first form that came into view as they walked toward the homestead was that of a very thin droid, dull gray in color, with weather-beaten metal coverings, covering. Obviously in need of a good oil bath, he bent stiffly and worked on some sort of fence sensor. Then he rose with a jerky motion, seeing their approach.
Oh, hello, he greeted. How might I be of service? I am C...
3PO? Anakin said breathlessly, hardly believing his eyes.
Oh, my,
the droid exclaimed, and he began to shake violently.
Oh, my maker, Master Anakin, I knew you would return, I knew you would. And this must be Miss Padme.
Hello, 3PO, Padme said.
Oh, my circuits, I'm so pleased to see you both.
I've come to see my mother, Anakin explained. The droid turned sharply up toward him, then seemed to shrink back.
I think...
C-3PO stuttered.
Perhaps we'd better go indoors.
He turned toward the homestead, motioning with his hand for the couple to follow. Anakin and Padme exchanged nervous glances. Anakin could not shake the feeling of doom that lingered long after the imagery of his nightmares had faded. By the time they caught up to the droid, he was in the courtyard shouting,
Master Kleeg! Master Owen! Might I present two important visitors?
A young man and woman came rushing out of the house, almost immediately, but slowed at the sight of Padme and Anakin. I'm Anakin Skywalker, Anakin said at once.
Anakin? The man echoed, his eyes going wide. Anakin!
The woman at his side brought her hand up to cover her mouth.
Anakin the Jedi, she whispered breathlessly.
You know of me? Shmi Skywalker is my mother.
Mine too, said the man. Not my real mom, he added, at Anakin's obviously puzzled look. But as real a mom as I've ever known.
He extended his hand. Owen Lars, this is my girlfriend, Beru Whiteson.
Beru nodded and said, Hello.
Padme, after giving up on Anakin, ever remembering to introduce her, came forward.
I'm Padme.
I guess I'm your stepbrother, Owen said, his eyes never leaving the young Jedi of whom he had heard so very much.
I had a feeling you might show up.
Is my mother here?
No, she's not,
came a gruff answer from behind Owen and Beru, from the shadows of the house door. All four turned to see a heavyset man glide out on a hover chair. One of his legs was heavily bandaged, the other missing, and Anakin knew at once that these were fairly recent wounds. His heart seemed to leap into his throat.
Kleeg Lars, the man said, moving in close and extending his hand. Shmi is my wife. We should go inside. We have a lot to talk about.
Anakin followed as if in a dream, a very horrible dream.
It was just before the dawn, Kleeg was saying,
gliding toward the table in the homestead kitchen with Owen beside him, while Beru peeled off to gather some food and drinks for the guests. They came out of nowhere, Owen added.
A band of Tusken raiders, Kleeg explained.
A sinking feeling nearly buckled Anakin's knees, and he slumped into a seat across from Owen. He'd had some experience with Tusken raiders, but on a very limited basis. Once he had tended the wound of one gravely injured raider, and when the Tusken's friends showed up, they had let him go. Something unheard of among the more civilized species of Tatooine. But still, despite that one anomaly, Anakin didn't like hearing the name of Shmi spoken in the same breath as the grim words, Tusken raiders.
Your mother had gone out early, like she always did,
to pick mushrooms that grow on the vaporators, Klieg explained. From the tracks, she was about halfway home when they took her. Those Tuskens walk like men, but they're vicious, mindless monsters.
We'd seen many signs that they were about, Owen piped in. She shouldn't have gone out.
We can't live huddled in fear, Klieg scolded.
But he calmed at once and turned back to Anakin.
All signs were that we'd chase the Tuskens away. We didn't know how strong this raiding band was. Stronger than anything any of us have ever seen. 30 of us went out after Shmi. 4 of us came back.
He grimaced and rubbed his leg, and Anakin felt the man's pain clearly.
I'd still be out there, only after I lost my leg.
Klieg nearly broke down, and it struck Anakin how much the man loved Shmi.
I just can't ride anymore, Klieg went on. Until I heal.
The proud man drew in a deep breath and forcibly steadied himself, squaring his broad shoulders.
This isn't the way I wanted to meet you, son, he said. This isn't how your mother and I planned it. I don't want to give up on her, but she's been gone a month. There's little hope she's lasted this long.
The words hit Anakin like a stinging slap, and he retreated from them, back into himself, back into the Force. He reached out, using his bond with his mother to try to somehow feel her presence in the Force. Then he shot to his feet.
Where are you going? Owen asked.
To find my mother, came the grim reply.
No, Anakin, Padme cried out, rising to grab his forearm.
Your mother's dead, son, the resigned Klieg added. Accept it.
Anakin glowered at him, at them all.
I can feel her pain, he said, his jaw clenched, teeth gritted. Continuing pain, and I will find her.
A moment of silence ensued, and then Owen offered,
Take my speeder bike.
He jumped up from his seat and strode by Anakin.
I know she's alive, Anakin said, turning to face Padme. I know it.
Padme winced but said nothing, and she let go of Anakin's arm as he moved to follow Owen.
I wish she'd have come a bit earlier, Klieg lamented.
Padme looked over at him and at Beru, who was standing over the tearful man hugging him. Then, having no words to offer, Padme turned and rushed out to join Anakin and Owen. By the time she caught up, Owen was heading back for the house, and Anakin was standing near the speeder, staring out over the empty desert.
You're going to have to stay here, Anakin said to her as she hurried to his side. These are good people. You'll be safe.
Anakin,
I know she's alive, he said, still staring out to the dunes.
Padme hugged him tightly.
Find her, she whispered.
I won't be long, he promised.
And he straddled the speeder bike, kicked it to life, and rocketed away across the dunes.
Chapter 18.
When the call beamed into the Jedi Temple on Coruscant, using Scramble Code 5 and in care of the Old Folks Home, Mace Windu and Yoda knew that it was important. Extremely important. They took the call in Yoda's apartment after Mace checked the corridor both ways, then pointedly closed the door. The hologram of Obi-Wan Kenobi appeared before them. The man was obviously on edge, glancing repeatedly over his shoulder.
Masters, I have successfully made contact with Lama Su, the Prime Minister of Kamino.
Ah, good it is that your planet you have found, Yoda said.
Right where your students predicted, Obi-Wan replied. These Kaminoans are cloners, best in the galaxy, I've been told. And from what I've seen, I don't doubt the claims.
Both Jedi Masters frowned.
They're using a bounty hunter named Jango Fett to create a clone army.
An army? Mace repeated.
For the Republic, came Obi-Wan's startling answer. What's more, I have a strong feeling that this bounty hunter is behind the plot to assassinate Senator Amidala.
Do you think these cloners are involved in that as well?
No, Master. There appears to be no motive.
Do not assume anything, Obi-Wan,
Yoda advised.
Clear your mind must be if you are to discover the real villain behind this plot.
Yes, Master, Obi-Wan said. Prime Minister Lama Su has informed me that the 1st Battalion of Clone Troopers are ready for delivery. He also wanted me to remind you that if we require more, and they've another 1,000,000 well on the way to completion, it will take more time to grow them.
1,000,000 clone warriors? Mace Windu asked in disbelief.
Yes, Master. They say Master Sifo Dyas placed the order for the clone army at the request of the Senate almost 10 years ago. I was under the impression that he was killed before that. Did the Council ever authorize the creation of a clone army?
No, Mace answered, without hesitation, and without even looking to Yoda for confirmation. Whoever placed that order did not have the authorization of the Jedi Council.
Then how? And why?
The mystery deepens, Mace said, and it is one that needs unraveling. For more reasons than the safety of Senator Amidala.
The clones are impressive, Master, Obi-Wan explained. They have been created and trained for one purpose alone.
Into custody, take this Jango Fett,
Yoda instructed.
Bring him here. Question him, we will.
Yes, Master. I will report back when I have him.
Obi-Wan glanced over his shoulder again and abruptly instructed R4 to cut the transmission.
A clone army, Mace remarked, alone with Yoda once again, the hologram gone. Why would Sifo Dyas...
When placed this order was, may provide insight,
Yoda said, and Mace nodded.
If the timing of the order was correct, then Sifo Dyas must have placed it right before he had died.
If this Jango Fett was involved in trying to kill the Senator, and just happened to be chosen as the source for a clone army created for the Republic...
Mace Windu stopped and shook his head. The coincidence was too great for those two items to be simple chance. But how could one tie in with the other? Was it possible that whoever decided to create the clone army was afraid that Senator Amidala would be a strong enough voice to prevent that army from being used?
The Jedi Master rubbed a hand over his forehead and looked to Yoda, who sat with his eyes closed, probably contemplating the same riddles as he was, Mace knew, and equally troubled, if not more so, more...
Blind we are, if the development of this clone army we could not see,
Yoda remarked.
I think it is time to inform the Senate that our ability to use the Force has diminished.
Only the Dark Lords of the Sith know of our weakness,
Yoda replied.
If informed the Senate is, multiply our adversaries' will.
For the two Jedi Masters, this surprising development was troubling on several different levels.
Obi-Wan moved along the corridor carefully. He knew nothing of Jango Fett's accomplishments, but he figured they must be considerable, given the selection of the man as the prototype for a clone army. Pausing, he closed his eyes and reached out to the Force, searching for hidden enemies. A moment later, convinced that Jango wasn't in the immediate area, he approached the door. Gently, he ran his fingers along the frame, sensing for potential traps, then finally touched the locking mechanism. Holding one hand there, he tried the door. It didn't budge. Obi-Wan reached for his lightsaber, thinking to shear through the portal, but he changed his mind, preferring subtlety. He closed his eyes and sent his strength through his outstretched hand and into the lock, manipulating the mechanism easily. Then, one hand going to his lightsaber, he tried the door again, and it slid open. As soon as he viewed the room inside, he knew that he wouldn't be needing his weapon. The apartment was in complete disorder. The drawers of every cabinet hung open, some lay on the floor, and the chairs were knocked all askew. To the side, the bedroom door was open, and it too was a wreck. All the signs within pointed to a hurried departure. Obi-Wan glanced all about, looking for some clue,
and his gaze finally settled on a thin computer screen set on a counter in the main living area. Rushing to it, he turned it on and recognized it at once as a security network, tied into various cams set about the immediate area. Obi-Wan scrolled from view to view, noting the corridor he had just traversed and various angles of the apartment itself. An outside view of the area showed the apartment's rain-lashed roof, and he could see himself through the transparent steel window. He continued his scroll, widening the lens and zooming in on anything suspicious. Then he got a shot of a nearby landing pad and an odd-looking ship with a wide flat base, narrowed to a point on the closest end and thinning as it climbed to a small compartment, perhaps large enough for two or three men. Rushing about the parked craft was a familiar figure, either Boba Fett or another clone. Obi-Wan nodded and smiled knowingly as he followed the boy's movements, recognizing from the fluidity and randomness of some small actions that this was indeed Boba and not a perfectly controlled and conditioned clone. Obi-Wan's grin didn't hold, though, as another familiar figure came into view. It was Jango, dressed in the armor and rocket pack the Jedi had seen before, on the streets of Coruscant. If Obi-Wan had had any doubts that Jango was the man who had hired Zam Wessel, those doubts were now gone. He bolted from the apartment and ran down the corridor, looking for a way out. Out. "Yeah, I'll let you fly it," Jango said to Boba. Boba punched a fist into the air in triumph, thrilled that his father was going to let him get behind the controls of Slave One. It had been a long time, months, since Boba had been allowed to sit behind the controls. "Not to take her out, though," Jango added, somewhat dimming the boy's jubilance. "We're going out hot, son, but we'll take her back out of lightspeed early, so you can get some time working her about. Can I put her down?" "We'll see." Boba knew that his father really meant no, but he didn't press the point. He understood that something big and dangerous was going on here around him, and so he decided to take whatever his dad offered and be happy with that. He hoisted another bag and climbed up the ramp to the small storage hold. He looked back at Jango as he did so, then looked past Jango, to a human form rushing out of the tower's turbo lift and toward them through the driving rain. "Dad, look!" As Jango swung about, Boba's eyes went wider still. The running figure was their Jedi visitor. And he was drawing his lightsaber and igniting a blue blade that hissed in the downpour. "Get on board," Jango called to him, but Boba hesitated, watching his father pull out his blaster and fire off a bolt at the charging Jedi. With amazing reflexes, Obi-Wan snapped his lightsaber about, deflecting the bolt harmlessly wide. "Boba!" Jango yelled, and the boy came out of his trance and scrambled up the ramp and into Slave One. Obi-Wan launched himself through the air at the bounty hunter. Another blaster shot followed, then another. And the Jedi easily picked them both off, deflecting one and turning the other back at Jango. But as the bolt ricocheted toward him, the bounty hunter leapt away, his rocket pack flaring to life, sending him up to the top of the nearby tower. Obi-Wan tumbled headlong, turning while he rolled to come around as Jango fired again. Without even thinking of the movement, letting the Force guide his hand, the Jedi brought his lightsaber to the left and down, knocking the energy bolt aside. "You're coming with me, Jango," he called. The man answered with a series of shots, a line of bolts coming at the Jedi. The lightsaber went alternately left, then right, picking off each one. And when Jango altered the pattern, left, right, then right again, the Force guided Obi-Wan's hand through. "Jango!" he started to call out. But then he realized that the bounty hunter's latest shot was not a bolt, but an explosive pack. And the next moment, he was diving, enhancing his leap with the Force. All of Slave One recoiled from the explosion outside, and the jolt sent Boba tumbling to the side. "Dad!" he cried. He scrambled to the view screen, flicking it on and orienting the cam on the scene below. He saw his father immediately and burst out in tears of relief. He calmed himself quickly, though, scanning the area for the enemy Jedi, and saw Obi-Wan coming over from a roll, back to his feet, and blocking another series of bolts with seeming ease. Boba scanned the panel, trying to remember all his lessons about Slave One, glad that he had been so diligent in his studies. With a wicked grin that would have made his father proud, Boba fired up the energy packs and clicked off the locking mechanism of the main laser. "Lock this, Jedi," he whispered. He took a bead on Obi-Wan and pulled the trigger.
"You have a lot to answer,"
Obi-Wan called the Jango, his voice sounding thin in the thunderous downpour and lashing wind.
"It'll go easier on you and on your son if..."
He stopped suddenly, registering the report of a heavy laser somewhere in his subconscious. The Force had him moving instinctively before he even understood what was happening, leaping and flying across the air in a double somersault. He landed to find the ground shaking violently under his feet, quaking from the thunder of Slave One's heavy laser cannon, which swung around to follow him. Obi-Wan had to dive again, but this time, the bouncing report sent him sprawling to the ground, his lightsaber skidding from his grasp across the rain-slicking surface. Fortunately, Slave One's cannon went quiet, the energy pack depleted for the moment, and Obi-Wan wasted no time leaping to his feet and charging at Jango Fett, who was coming hard his way. A blaster bolt led the bounty hunter in, but Obi-Wan leapt above the streaking light of energy, flying forward and spinning around to snap-kick the weapon from Jango's hand. The bounty hunter didn't flinch. He charged right into the Jedi as Obi-Wan landed, looping his arms over Obi-Wan's and bearing him backward. He tried to wrestle Obi-Wan to the ground, but the Jedi's feet were too quick for that, setting him in perfect balance almost immediately. He slid one leg between the bounty hunter's feet and started to twist to the side, weakening Jango's hold on his arms. Jango smiled wickedly and snapped his forehead into Obi-Wan's face, dazing him for a moment. The bounty hunter pulled a hand free and launched a heavy punch, but realized his mistake immediately as the Jedi ducked the blow and did a tight, stationary somersault right under the swinging arm, double-kicking out as he came over, his feet slamming Jango in the chest and throwing him backward. Now Obi-Wan had gained the initiative, and he used it with a fierce charge, slamming into the stumbling bounty hunter, thinking to bring him down to the ground beneath him, where the encumbering armor the man wore would work against him. But Jango showed the Jedi why he had been chosen as the basis for the clones. He went with the flow of the tackle for a moment, then suddenly reversed his footing and his momentum, stopping Obi-Wan's progress cold. Jango launched a left hook. Obi-Wan ducked and snapped out a straight right in response. Jango slipped his head to the side so that the blow barely grazed him. A short rocket burst had him in the air and spinning a circle kick out at Obi-Wan, who dropped to his knees and ducked it, then came up high in a leap over the second kick as Jango came around again. Now Obi-Wan snapped off a kick of his own, but Jango accepted the blow against his lowered hip and snapped his left arm down across the Jedi's shin, locking the leg long enough for him to drive a right cross into Obi-Wan's inner thigh. The Jedi threw his head and torso back, lying flat out and lifting his left leg as he did, kicking Jango under the side of his ribs. A sudden scissor twist, right leg going down and across, left leg shooting across the other way above it, had Jango and Obi-Wan spinning sidelong. Obi-Wan caught himself with extended arms as he turned face down, broke his feet from their hold on Jango, and mule-kicked the falling man backward. Then, going down to the platform to launch himself right back up to his feet, he turned about and rushed forward, gaining an advantage on the off-balance and struggling Jango. A right cross smashed the bounty hunter across the face, followed by a looping left hook that should have laid the man low. But again, with brilliant reflexes, Jango ducked the brunt of that blow and caught the surprised Obi-Wan with a sudden and short but heavy left and right in the gut. The Jedi's right hand waved across between his face and Jango's, and used a quick force shove to throw the man back a step until he could straighten and find the defensive posture once more. Jango came right back in, fiercely, wildly, kicking and punching with abandon. Obi-Wan's hands worked vertically before him, hardly moving, amazingly precise, turning blow after blow harmlessly aside. He turned one hand in and down suddenly, taking the momentum from a heavy kick, then came right back up to lift Jango's jabbing fist up high. Then he snapped his hand straight out, his stiffened fingers smashing against a seam in the bounty hunter's armor. Jango winced and fell back. Obi-Wan launched himself forward, diving onto the man, going for the victory. But Jango had an answer, firing his rockets and lifting both himself and the grappling Jedi up into the air. A burst of a side thruster sent the pair out past the landing pad proper to the sloping skirt of the structure. Jango's hands worked almost imperceptibly, twisting in and about the Jedi's arms and hands, expertly loosening Obi-Wan's grip. Then he fired his thrusters left and right, causing a sudden and repeated jerk that broke him free of Obi-Wan's grasp. Obi-Wan hit the deck hard and slid perilously close to the edge, close enough to hear the great waves breaking against the platform's stilts below him. He caught a hold and reached into the Force, using it to grab his lightsaber, recognizing that he was suddenly vulnerable. He heard a shot from the side, not the screech of a blaster bolt, but a sound, and rolled as far as he could. But not far enough. He lost his concentration, along with his grasp on his lightsaber, as a thin wire slid under his wrists, then wrapped about them, securing him tightly. And then he was sliding, back up the sloping skirt and across the platform, towed by the Rocket Man. With reflexes honed by years of intensive training, and with the Force strength of a Jedi Master, Obi-Wan snap-rolled his body forward, back up over his outstretched arms, tumbling to his feet, then leaping out to the side as the tow line again went taut, jerking him along. He rolled about a pylon and came back to his feet again, now having the leverage of the metal pole helping to hold him there. Reaching deeply in the Force once more, he grounded himself, becoming for an instant almost as one with the platform. Immovable. The wire snapped tightly, but Obi-Wan didn't budge. He felt the angle of the pull change dramatically as the Rocket Man plunged to the deck, his pack breaking away. Obi-Wan started around the pole, but stopped and shielded his eyes as Jango Fett's rocket pack exploded with a burst of light and a tremendous concussion. "Dad!" Boba Fett cried as the rocket pack blew apart, his face coming right to the view screen. But then he saw Jango, off to the side and apparently unharmed, though tugging frantically against the pull of the wire that was now being controlled by the Jedi. Boba slapped one hand helplessly against the screen, mouthing "Dad" again, and then he winced as the Jedi slammed into his father, kicking and butting him, and both of them, locked together, went rolling off the back edge of the landing pad, sliding fast down the skirt and toward the raging ocean. Obi-Wan kicked and tried to find his way back to the Force, but Jango punched him repeatedly. He could hardly believe that the bounty hunter would waste the effort, with certain death awaiting them both at the end of the slide and fall. He managed to pull back somewhat and saw Jango lift one forearm, a strange smile on his face. The bounty hunter clenched his fist, and a line of claws popped forth from the armor. Obi-Wan instinctively recoiled as Jango lifted that arm higher. But then the bounty hunter slammed it down, not on Obi-Wan, but on the platform skirt. At the same time, Jango worked his other hand, releasing the locking mechanism of the wire-launching bracelet, and it slid free of his arm. He screeched to a halt, and Obi-Wan slid past him. "Catch a roller fish for me," the Jedi heard Jango say. And then he was falling, over the lip, and down toward the raging whitecaps. "Dad! Oh, Dad!" Boba Fett cried in relief as he spotted his father clambering back over the skirt lip and onto the platform. Jango climbed to his feet and stumbled toward Slave One, and Boba rushed to the hatch, sliding it open and reaching down to help his father aboard. "Get us out of here," the dazed and battered Jango said, and Boba grinned and rushed to the control panel, firing up the engines.
"I'll put her right to light speed."
"Just break atmosphere and take her straight out,"
Jango ordered, and his words came out with a growl of pain as he held his bruised side. Then he noticed his son's wounded look.
"Get the nav computer online and have it set the coordinates for the jump," he conceded.
Boba's smile beamed brighter than ever.
"Lift off!"
he shouted. Obi-Wan used the Force to grab the trailing loose end of the wire that still held him by the wrists, and he threw that end out, looping it over a crossbeam in the platform structure. His descent stopped with a sudden jerk. He glanced around, then began to swing back and forth, gaining momentum until he was far enough out to pull himself free of the bond and drop lightly onto a small surface platform, barely above the lashing waves. He took only a moment to catch his breath, and then opened the door of the service turbo lift with a wave of his hand. Even before the door opened at the landing platform, he heard the engines of the bounty hunter ship roar to life. He came over the lift, spotting his lightsaber immediately and calling it into him with the Force. But he was too late. The ship was already shuddering, ready to blast away. Obi-Wan pulled a small transmitter from his belt and threw it out long and far at Slave One. The magnetic lock of the tracking device grasped on to the ship's hull just in time. Rain and steam pouring all about him, Obi-Wan Kenobi stood there for a long while, until Slave One disappeared from view. He looked around at the platform, replaying the battle in his head, his respect for this bounty hunter, Jango Fett, growing considerably. He understood now why Jango had been selected by Sifo Dyas, or Tyrannus, or whoever it was that selected him. The man was good, full of tricks, and full of skill. He had taken Obi-Wan Kenobi, a Jedi Knight, the man who had defeated the Sith Lord Darth Maul, to the very precipice of disaster. But Obi-Wan was still pleased at the way it had played out. He would track Jango now. Perhaps at the end of the coming journey, he would finally get some answers instead of even more riddles. Chapter 19. Boba sat quietly, sensing the tension, as Slave One blasted away from Kamino. He wanted to talk about his shot with the laser cannon, about how he had knocked the Jedi down and sent his lightsaber flying away. But this wasn't the time, he knew, for Jango wore an intense expression that Boba recognized all too well, one that told him clearly that now was not the time for him to speak. The boy rested back against the wall farthest from his father as Jango worked the controls, setting the coordinates for the jump to hyperspace. "Come on, come on," Jango said repeatedly, rocking back and forth, as if urging the ship on, and glancing over at the sensors every few seconds, as if he expected a fleet of starships to be chasing them away. Then he gave a shout of victory and punched the hyperdrive, and Boba went back against the wall, watching the stars elongate. Jango Fett slumped back in his seat and breathed a sigh of relief, his expression softening almost immediately. "Well, that was a bit too close," he said with a laugh. "You smashed him good," Boba replied, his excitement beginning to bubble up again. "He never had a chance against you, Dad." Jango smiled and nodded. "To tell the truth, son, he had me in real trouble there," he admitted. "After he dodged that explosive pack, I'd about run out of tricks." Boba frowned at first, wanting to argue against anyone ever getting the upper hand on his father. But then, as he considered the moment Jango had mentioned, his frown became a wide smile. "I got him good with the laser cannon." "You did great," Jango replied. "You fired at just the right time, and were right there, ready to help me in when it was time for us to go. You're learning well, Boba. Better than I ever believed possible." "That's because I'm a little you," the boy reasoned, but Jango was shaking his head. "You're better than I was at your age, and by a long way. And if you keep working hard, you'll be the best bounty hunter this galaxy's ever seen." "Which was your plan from the beginning with the Kaminoans, right, Dad? That's why you wanted me." Jango Fett moved over and lifted one hand to tousle Boba's hair. "That and a lot of other reasons," he said quietly, reverently. "And in every regard, in every hope and dream, you've done better than I ever expected." There was nothing that anyone in all the galaxy could ever have said to young Boba Fett to make him feel better than those words from his father. Jango took Slave One out of hyperspace a bit early, so that Boba could have some time piloting the ship on the approach to Geonosis. For Boba, sitting in the chair beside his father, working the controls deftly, even showing off a bit, there could be no greater moment. And the boy was saddened by the sight of the red planet, Geonosis, and the asteroid belts that ringed it. "Security's tight here," Jango explained, taking the helm. "It'll be better if I put her down." Boba sat back in the chair without complaint. He knew his father was right, and even if he had disagreed, he wouldn't have done so openly. He turned his attention to the scan screens, showing the composition of the asteroid field nearby, and some distant traffic around the other side of the planet. He noted one blip in particular, disengaging from the asteroid belt and moving out behind Slave One. He didn't think too much of it at first, until a second blip appeared, right behind Slave One, though nothing substantial enough to be a separate ship.
"Nearly there, son," Jango remarked.
"Dad, I think we're being tracked," Boba told him. "Look at the scan screen. Isn't that a cloaking shadow of our own ship?" Jango looked at him doubtfully, then turned that skeptical expression upon the scan screen. Boba watched with mounting excitement as his father's gaze turned intense and he slowly began to nod.
"That Jedi must have put a tracking device on our hull before we left Kamino," he agreed. "But how? I thought he was dead."
"Someone's following us," Boba observed.
"We'll fix that," Jango assured him. "Hang on, son. Watch me put us into that asteroid field. He won't be able to follow us there."
He looked over at Boba and winked.
"And if he does, we'll leave him a couple of surprises."
Jango opened a side panel and pulled a lever, releasing an electric charge along his hull that was designed to destroy just such tracking devices. A quick look at the scan screen showed that the cloaking shadow had disappeared.
"Here we go," Jango said,
and he dived Slave One into the asteroid field, pulling a fast circuit over and around the nearby rock, then diving out fast to the side, rolling about a spinning boulder and cutting fast between another pair. In and around he wove, with no apparent pattern, and a few moments later, Boba, who was still studying the scanner, announced, "He's gone."
"Maybe he's smarter than I thought, and headed on toward the planet's surface," Jango said with a grin and another wink.
Even as he finished, though, the scanner beeped.
"Look, Dad,"
Boba cried, pointing out the blip, now inside the asteroid field as well.
"He's back."
"Hang on," Jango said,
and he put Slave One through a wild series of dips, climbs, and turns, then finished with a straight-out run, while uncapping a firing trigger and squeezing the plunger.
"Seismic charge," he explained to Boba, who grinned.
But then the boy was screaming a warning as the forward view screen filled up with an asteroid. Jango was already on it, turning the amazingly maneuverable Slave One up on its end and running up over the giant space rock.
"Stay calm, son," he assured Boba. "We'll be fine. That Jedi won't be able to follow us through this."
His declaration was accentuated by a sudden flash and a jarring buck as the sonic charge detonated far behind them.
"He got through it,"
Boba cried a moment later, seeing the Jedi ship reappear on the scan screen.
"This guy can't take a hint," said Jango, who remained unrattled. "Well, if we can't lose him, we'll have to finish him."
Boba cried out again, but his father was in complete control. He put the ship down a narrow tunnel, creasing one of the larger asteroids. He had to slow a bit to maneuver, and when Slave One came out the other end, Jango and Boba saw the Jedi starfighter stream over and past them. The hunted had suddenly become the hunters.
"Get him, Dad!" Boba cried out. "Get him! Fire!"
Laser bolts burst out of Slave One, tracing lines all about the starfighter, which cut a snap roll to the right and down. Jango stayed with him, trying to line up another shot, but the Jedi was good, snap rolling one after another, each time coming out near an asteroid and sliding behind it for cover. Boba continued to urge his father on, but Jango kept his patience, figuring that sooner or later, the Jedi was going to run out of cover. A fast dive, then a sudden turn back up, then a sudden roll and back to the right had the Jedi moving behind yet another asteroid, But this time, instead of following, Jango cut in short of the rock and fired blindly past it. Out came the Jedi starfighter right into the line of fire, and the ship bucked, pieces flying, as a laser bolt clipped it.
"You got him!" Boba yelled in victory.
"And now we just have to finish him," the ever-cool Jango explained. "There'll be no more dodging."
He pushed a series of buttons, arming a torpedo and sliding open the tube, then moved to punch the red trigger. He paused, though, and smiled, and nodded for Boba to move closer. Boba could hardly breathe as his father slid his hand onto the smooth trigger grip, then looked down at him and nodded. The boy punched the trigger and Slave One jolted as the torpedo slid away, diving at the Jedi starfighter and taking up the chase as the starfighter bolted and tried to evade. A few brief moments later, Slave One's viewscreen lit up in the light of a tremendous explosion, forcing Boba and Jango to shield their eyes with their arms. When they recovered and looked back, they were greeted by pieces of wreckage and torn chunks of metal. The scan screen was clear.
"Got him!" Boba shouted. "Yeah!"
"Nice shot, kid," Jango said,
and he tousled Boba's hair again.
"You earned that one. We won't see him again."
A few deft turns had Slave One out of the asteroids and speeding down toward Geonosis, and despite his earlier reasoning, Jango Fett allowed Boba to guide the craft down. Truly, this was no flight for a boy to pilot, but Boba Fett was so far above any ordinary boy. Anakin traveled through great canyons of multicolored stone, across dunes of blowing and shifting sand, and along an ancient, long, dry riverbed. His only guide was the sensation of Shmi, of her pain. But it was not a definitive homing beacon, and though he suspected he was moving in the general direction, the landscape of Tatooine was vast and empty, and none knew how to hide among the sand and stones better than the Tusken Raiders. On a high bluff, Anakin paused and scanned the horizon. Off to the south, he noted a huge vehicle resembling a gigantic tilting box, plodding along on a single huge track. Nodding with recognition of the Jawas, and well aware that no one knew the movements of all creatures among the desert better than they, he kicked his speeder bike away. He caught up to them soon after, riding into a group of the brown and black-robed creatures, their inquisitive red eyes poking out at him from the shadows of huge cowls, their ceaseless chatter humming like strange music all about him. It took him a long time to convince the Jawas that he wasn't interested in purchasing any droids, and a longer time to get them to understand that he was merely looking for information about any Tusken Raiders. The Jawas talked excitedly among themselves, pointing this way and that, hopping all about. Jawas were no friends of Tuskens, who preyed on them, as they preyed on anyone else they found vulnerable. Even worse to the Jawa salesman mentality, Tuskens never purchased any droids. The group eventually came to agreement and pointed as one to the east. With a nod, Anakin sped away. The lack of monetary compensation seemed to aggravate the Jawas, but Anakin had no time to care. The asteroids rolled along their silent way, undisturbed, seemingly unshaken from the explosions and zigzagging vessels. In a deep depression on the backside of one such rock, huddled a small starfighter, its definitive outline and consistent colors showing stark contrast to the rough-edged and bleeding, broken mineral streaks of the asteroid.
"Blast! This is why I hate flying,"
Obi-Wan said to R4, and the droid's responding beeps showed that he was in complete agreement. Few things could rattle the Jedi Knight, but engaging in a space battle with a pilot as obviously skilled as Jango Fett was surely one of them. Unlike many of his Jedi associates, Obi-Wan Kenobi had never much enjoyed space travel, let alone piloting. He winced as his asteroid came over and around, showing him again a glowing piece of torn metal that had taken up orbit within the belt. His ship was wounded from the laser blast. Nothing substantial, just a thruster angler. And he had understood that he could not hope to outmaneuver the clever torpedo. So he had ordered R4 to eject all the spare parts canisters. And fortunately, that had been enough to detonate the missile. Despite the success, between the shock of that blast and landing hard and fast on the asteroid to complete the ruse, Obi-Wan was relieved to see that his ship had remained intact. He wanted no further space fights with Jango and his strange and supremely efficient ship, though, and so he had sat here as the minutes slipped past. "Have you got their last trajectory logged?" he asked the droid. Then nodded, as R4 assured him that he did. "Well, I think we've waited long enough. Let's go." Obi-Wan paused for a moment, trying to digest all the amazing things he had seen on the trail of Jango Fett. "This mystery gets more wound up all the time, R4. Think maybe we'll finally get some answers?" R4 gave a sound that Obi-Wan can only think of as a verbal shrug. Following the path taken by Slave One, Obi-Wan was not surprised that it led straight for the red planet, Geonosis. What did surprise him, though, was that they were not alone up there. A series of beeps and whistles from R4 alerted him, and Obi-Wan adjusted his scan screen accordingly, locking onto a huge fleet of vessels settled on the other side of the asteroid belt. "Trade Federation ships," he mused aloud, as he angled to get a better view. "So many?" He shook his head in confusion, noting several of the great battleships among the group. Their unique design made them hard to miss. A sphere, surrounded by a nearly enclosed ring. If the clone army was for the Republic, commissioned by a Jedi Master, and Jango Fett was the basis for the clones, then what ties would Jango have to the Trade Federation? And if Jango was indeed behind the assassination attempts on Senator Amidala, the leading voice of opposition to creating a Republic army, then why would the Trade Federation approve? It occurred to Obi-Wan that he might have misjudged Jango, or misjudged his motivations at least. Maybe Jango, like Obi-Wan and Anakin, had been chasing the bounty hunter who had tried to kill Amidala. Maybe the toxic dart had been fired not to silence the would-be assassin, but as punishment for the attempt on Amidala's life. The Jedi couldn't convince himself of that, though. He still believed that Jango was the man behind the assassination attempt, and that he had killed the changeling so that she could not give him up. But why the clone army? And why the Trade Federation ties? There was no apparent logic to it. He knew that he would get no answers up here, so he took his ship down toward Geonosis, keeping the asteroid belt between him and the Trade Federation fleet. He went down low as soon as he broke Geonosis' atmosphere, ducking below any tracking systems that might be in place, skimming the red plains and broken stones, weaving around the buttes and mesas. The whole of the planet seemed a barren and arid red plain, but his scanners did pick up some activity in the distance. Obi-Wan skimmed that way, climbing one mesa and running low to its far end. He slid his ship under a rocky overhang and put her down, then climbed out and walked to the mesa edge. The night air had a curious metallic taste to it, and the temperature was comfortable. A strong breeze blew in Obi-Wan's face, carrying that metallic taste and odor, and the occasional strange cry. "I'll be back, R4. The droid gave a long... "You'll be fine," Obi-Wan assured him. "And I won't be long." Glad to be back on the ground once again, Obi-Wan checked his bearings, measured against the area where he had noted the activity, and started off, moving along a rocky trail. The hours were unbearable for Padme. Owen and Beru were friendly enough, and Cleek was obviously glad for the added company in his time of great concern and profound grief. But she could hardly speak to them, so worried was she for Anakin. She had never seen him in a mood like the one that had taken him from the moisture farm. His determination so palpable, so consuming, that it seemed almost destructive. She had felt Anakin's power in that parting, an inner strength beyond anything she had ever known. If his mother was indeed alive, and she believed that Shmi was, since Anakin had said so, Padme knew that no army would be strong enough to keep the young Jedi from her. She didn't sleep that night, rising often from her bed and pacing all about the compound. She wandered into the garage area, alone with her thoughts. Or so she believed.
"Hello, Miss Padme,"
came a chipper voice. And as soon as Padme got over the initial shock, she recognized the speaker.
"You can't sleep?"
C-3PO asked.
No, I have too many things on my mind, I guess.
Are you worried about your work in the Senate?
No, I'm just concerned about Anakin. I said things. I'm afraid I might have hurt him. I don't know. Maybe I only hurt myself. For the first time in my life, I'm confused.
I'm not sure it will make you feel any better, Miss Padme. But I don't think there's been a time in my life when I haven't been confused.
I want him to know that I care about him, 3PO, Padme said quietly. I do care about him. And now he's out there and in danger.
Don't worry about Master Annie,
the droid assured her, moving over to pat her shoulder.
He can take care of himself, even in this awful place.
Awful? Padme asked. You're not happy here? C-3PO stepped back and held his hands out wide, showing his battered coverings and the chipped insulation in those areas where some of his wiring showed. Padme moved forward, bending to see, and noticed sand clinging in many of the droid's joints.
Well, this is a very harsh environment, I'm afraid,
the droid explained.
And when Master Ani made me, he never quite found the time to give me any outer coverings. Mistress Shmi did well in finishing me, but even with the coverings, the wind and the sand are quite harsh. It gets in under my coverings, and it's quite itchy.
Itchy? Padme echoed with a laugh. A much-needed laugh.
I do not know how else to describe it, Miss Padme. And I fear that the sand is doing damage to my wiring.
Padme looked all around, her gaze settling on a chain hoist over an open tub of dark liquid. You need an oil bath, she said.
Oh, I would welcome a bath.
Glad for the distraction, Padme moved to the oil tub and began sorting out the hoist chain. In a short while, she had C-3PO secured and everything in place, and she gently lowered the droid into the oil.
Ooh,
the droid cried.
That tickles.
Tickles? You're sure it's not an itch?
I do know the difference between a tickle and an itch, C-3PO answered.
Padme giggled and forgot for a while all of her troubles. As soon as he came upon the grisly scene, Anakin knew that it was the work of Tuskens. Three farmers, likely some of those whom Kleeg had been with before being forced to return home, lay dead about a campfire, their bodies battered and torn. A pair of Eopes, long-legged dromedaries with big padded feet and equine faces that showed little intelligence, stood tethered nearby, lowing mournfully, and beyond them hung the smoking remains of a speeder. Anakin ran his fingers through his hair. Calm down, he told himself. Find her. He fell within himself then, within the Force, and sent his senses out far and wide, needing the confirmation that his mother had not yet met a similar fate. A stab of pain assaulted him, and a cry that was both hopeful and helpless entered his mind. Mom, he mouthed breathlessly, and he knew that time was running out, that Shmi was in terrible pain and was barely holding on. He didn't have the time to bury the poor farmers, but he did resolve to come back for them. He jumped astride the speeder bike and put it flat out, rushing across the dark desert landscape, following Shmi's call. The trail was narrow and steep, but at least Obi-Wan was back on solid footing. Or almost solid, he realized. As a shrill shriek split the air, startling him, his foot slipped. He nearly tumbled but caught his balance, as a bunch of stones fell loose, bouncing down the side of the mesa. The Jedi drew out his lightsaber, but did not ignite it. He moved along cautiously, down and around a bend in the rocky path. He saw the large lizard-like creature coming for him, its huge fangs dripping lines of drool. It stood on strong hind legs, its little forelegs twitching eagerly. The lightsaber hummed to life, and Obi-Wan dived down to the side, slashing back as he fell, opening the creature's side from foreleg to hind. The creature landed and tried to turn,
but as it spasmed in pain, it overbalanced and fell off the trail, plummeting hundreds of feet and shrieking all the way. Obi-Wan had no time to watch the descent, though, for another of the beasts appeared, coming at him fast, its toothy maw open wide. The Jedi filled that maw with lightsaber, shearing through teeth and gums, driving the blade right through the back of the creature's head. He pulled hard to the side, the energy blade tearing right through the beast's skull, and turned to face yet another leaping beast. Falling back and down, he let the lizard fly past. Then he came up immediately and started to pursue. But abruptly he stopped, reversed his grip, and stabbed out behind him, impaling a fourth creature. He spun about, flipping the weapon from his right hand to his left, then slashed it out the side of the dying beast as he completed his circuit, coming right around to face the one that had leapt past. The creature circled slowly, seemingly sizing him up, and Obi-Wan turned with it, but kept his eyes and ears scanning the area. He tried to scare the creature off, and with two of its companions lying dead on the rocks, and a third having gone over the cliff, he fully expected it to flee. But not this fierce beast. It charged suddenly, jaws snapping. A sidestep, forward step, and overhand slash had the creature's head rolling free on the ground. "Fun place," the Jedi remarked after a while, when he was confident that no more of the creatures were about. He put his weapon away and moved along, and soon after rounded the corner of the mesa. A great plain spread out wide before him, with many tall shapes in the far distance, indistinguishable in the darkness. Obi-Wan took out his electro-binoculars and peered across the plain. He saw a cluster of great towers, not natural stalagmites like those he had seen dotting the landscape, but shaped structures. A roll of his finger increased the magnification of both size and available light, and he scanned slowly to the side. Trade Federation starships, scores of them, lined the region, settled on platforms. The Jedi watched in amazement as another platform rose beside one ship, and thousands of battle droids stepped off it and into the vessel, which then lifted away, and was quickly replaced by another starship, settling down on the platform. Another platform rose to the side, and again, thousands of droids stepped off to board the waiting starship, and that one, now filled with droid soldiers, lifted away. "Unbelievable," the Jedi muttered, and he looked to the eastern horizon, trying to gauge the amount of time he had before dawn, wondering if he could make the run before the light found him. Not if he had to slowly work his way down the mesa, he realized. And so he shrugged and stepped ahead, closing his eyes and finding his power in the Force. Then he leapt out, lifting himself with the Force to ease his descent. He hit a bluff many feet down, but sprang away and fell again and again, half bouncing, half flying his way down to the dark plain. The sun was still below the eastern rim, though the land was beginning to lighten around him, when he reached the grandest tower of the complex. The entryway was heavily guarded by battle droids, but Obi-Wan had no intention of going anywhere near that area. Using the Force and his own conditioning, the Jedi scaled the tower until he came to a small window. He slipped in silently and moved from shadow to shadow, then ducked behind a wind curtain as he heard the approach of a pair of strange-looking creatures. Geonosians, he supposed. They wore little clothing, and their skin was reddish, like the air about them, with flaps hanging in rolls in many places about their slender frames. Leathery wings showed behind their bony shoulders. Their heads were large and elongated, their skulls ridged top and side, and they had thick-lidded bulbous eyes. Their expression seemed to be locked in a perpetual scowl.
"Too many sentients," he heard one of them say.
"It is not your place to question Archduke Poggle the Lesser," the other scolded. And grumbling, the pair wandered away. Obi-Wan moved out behind them, going the opposite way.
He slipped from shadow to shadow along a narrow corridor lined with pillars. He couldn't help but see the contrast between this place and Topoka City. Where Topoka City was a work of art, all rounded and smooth, all glass and light, this place was rough-edged, all sharp corners and utilitarian features. The Jedi moved along, coming to an open vent, sharp noises and pounding echoing up from it. He dropped to the ground and looked all about, then crawled and peered over the edge. A factory. A huge alignment of conveyor belts and pounding machines lay below in a wide-open area. Obi-Wan watched in blank amazement as many, many Geonosians, these without wings like the pair that had walked past him, worked at various stations assembling droids. At the far end of the conveyor, completed droids stepped off under their own power, walking away down a distant corridor, to platforms that would lift them to waiting Trade Federation starships, the Jedi realized. With a shake of his head, Obi-Wan ran along, and then he sensed something, fleeting but definite. He followed his instincts along the maze of corridors, at last coming to a vast underground chamber, with huge vaulted ceilings and rough-styled arches. He started across, moving pillar to pillar, sensing that something or someone was near. He heard their voices before he saw them, and he fell flat against a stone. A group of six figures walked past him, four in front and two behind. Two Geonosians were in that front row, along with a Nemoidian viceroy, whom Obi-Wan knew all too well, and a man whose features were also recognizable from busts the Jedi had seen in the temple on Coruscant.
"Now we must persuade the Commerce Guild and the Corporate Alliance to sign the treaty," that former Jedi, Count Dooku, was saying. The man was tall and regal, with perfect posture and a graceful gait. His hair was silver and perfectly trimmed, and his elegant features, strong jaw, and piercing eyes completed the look of a man who had once been among the greatest of the Jedi. He wore a black cape, clipped at his neck by a silver chain, and a black shirt and pants of the finest materials. In looking at him, in feeling his presence, Obi-Wan understood that nothing less would ever suit this one.
"What about the senator from Naboo?"
asked the Nemoidian, Newt Gunray, his beady eyes and thin features seeming smaller still beneath the tri-pronged headdress he always wore.
"Is she dead yet? I'm not signing your treaty until I have her head on my desk."
Obi-Wan nodded, huge pieces of the puzzle starting to fall into place. It made sense to him that Newt Gunray would want Amidala dead, even if her voice of opposition to an army of the Republic was working in his favor. Amidala had embarrassed the Nemoidian badly in the Battle of Naboo, after all.
"I am a man of my word, Viceroy," one of the Separatists answered.
"With these new battle droids we've built for you, Viceroy, you'll have the finest army in the galaxy," said the Geonosian,
whom Obi-Wan believed to be Poggle the Lesser. He didn't look much like the winged commoners and workers Obi-Wan had seen. His skin was lighter, more a grayish tan than red-tinted, and his head was huge, his large, scowling mouth protruding just a bit, giving him a fierce appearance, an elongated chin that seemed more a long beard hung halfway down his torso. They continued their banter, but had moved out of earshot by then, and Obi-Wan didn't dare step out to follow. They moved across the way, through an archway and up a flight of stairs. After a short pause to make sure they were well along, Obi-Wan rushed out, peeking through to the stairs, then crept up them, coming to a narrow archway overlooking a smaller room. Inside, he saw the six who had passed, along with several others, notably three opposition senators the Jedi recognized. First came Poe Nudo of Ando and Aqualish, who looked as if he was wearing a helmet with great goggles, but was not, of course. Beside him sat Necklace Toonbuck Tura of Sea Mirth,
with her rodent-like head and wide mouth, and the Quarren Senator Tesek, his face tentacles waggling anxiously. Obi-Wan had met this trio before, back on Coruscant. Yes, he realized. It seemed he had walked into the center of the hive.
You have met Shu Mai?
Count Dooku, seated at the head of the table, asked the three senators.
Representing the Commerce Guild.
Across the way, Shu Mai nodded deferentially. Her delicate and gray wrinkled head was set on a long neck, and her most striking feature, aside from long and pointy horizontal ears, was a hairstyle that looked much like a skin-covered horn protruding out the back of her skull, rising up and curving forward.
And this is San Hill, distinguished member of the Intergalactic Banking Clan, Dooku went on, indicating a creature with the longest and narrowest face Obi-Wan had ever seen.
Those gathered about the table murmured their greetings, nodded to each other for many moments, and then they went silent, all eyes settling on Count Dooku, who seemed to Obi-Wan in complete control here, even above the Archduke of the planet.
As I explained to you earlier, I'm quite convinced that 10,000 more systems will rally to our cause with your support, the Count said. And let me remind you of our absolute commitment to capitalism, to the lower taxes, the reduced tariffs, and the eventual abolition of all trade barriers. Signing this treaty will bring you profits beyond your wildest imagination. What we are proposing is complete free trade.
He looked to Newt Gunray, who nodded.
Our friends in the Trade Federation have pledged their support, Count Dooku went on. When their battle droids are combined with yours, we shall have an army greater than anything in the galaxy. The Republic will be overwhelmed.
If I may, Count, said one of the others, one of the two who had trailed Dooku to the room.
Yes, Passel Argenti, Count Dooku said. We are always interested in hearing from the Corporate Alliance.
The huddled and nervous man offered a slight bow to Dooku.
I am authorized by the Corporate Alliance to sign the treaty.
We are most grateful for your cooperation, Magistrate, Dooku said.
Obi-Wan recognized that exchange for what it was. A play for the benefit of the other less enthusiastic people at the table. Count Dooku was trying to build some momentum. That momentum hit a bit of a bump a moment later, though, when Shu Mai piped in.
The Commerce Guild at this time does not wish to become openly involved.
However, she smoothed it over immediately.
But we shall support you in secret and look forward to doing business with you.
Several chuckles erupted about the table, and Count Dooku only smiled.
That is all we ask, he assured Shu Mai.
Then he looked to the distinguished member of the banking clan, and all the other gazes settled on San Hill as well.
The Intergalactic Banking Clan will support you wholeheartedly, Count Dooku, San Hill declared, but only in a non-exclusive arrangement.
Obi-Wan settled back, trying to sort out the implications of it all. Count Dooku had it all falling together here, a threat beyond anything the Republic had expected. With the money of the bankers and the commercial and trade guilds behind him, and this factory, and likely many others like it, churning out armies of battle droids, the potential danger was staggering. Was that why Sifo Dyas had commissioned the clone army? Had the Master sensed this growing danger, perhaps? But if that was true, then what was the tie between Jango Fett and this group on Geonosis? Was it mere coincidence that the man chosen as source for the clone army to defend the Republic had been hired by the Trade Federation to kill Senator Amidala? It seemed too much a coincidence to Obi-Wan, but he had little else to go on. He wanted to hang around and listen in some more, but he knew then that he had to get out of there.
had to return to his ship in R4 and get a warning out across the galaxy to the Jedi Council. Over the last hours, Obi-Wan had seen nothing but armies, clone android, and he knew that it would all be coming together very quickly in an explosion beyond anything the galaxy had seen in many, many centuries. Chapter 20. She wasn't seeing much with her eyes. Caked with blood and swollen from the beatings, they would hardly open. She wasn't hearing much with her ears, for the sounds around her were harsh and threatening, relentlessly so. And she wasn't feeling with her body, for there was nothing there but pain. No, Shmi had fallen inside herself, reliving those moments long ago when she and Anakin had lived their lives as Watto's slaves. It was not an easy life, but she had her Annie with her, and given that, Shmi could remember those times fondly. Only now, with the prospects for ever seeing her son again so distant, did she truly appreciate how much she had missed the boy over the last 10 years. All those times staring up at the night sky, she had thought of him, had imagined him soaring across the galaxy, rescuing the downtrodden, saving planets from ravaging monsters and evil tyrants. But she had always expected to see her Annie again, had always expected him to walk onto the moisture farm one day. That impish smile of his, the one that could light up a room, greeting her as if they had never been apart. Shmi had loved Kleeg and Owen, truly she had. Kleeg was her rescuer, her dashing knight. And Owen had been like the son she had lost, always compassionate, always happy to listen to her endless stories of Anakin's exploits. And Shmi was growing to love Beru, too. Who could not? Beru was that special combination of compassion and quiet inner strength. But despite the good fortune that had brought those three into her life, improving her lot a millionfold, Shmi Skywalker had always kept a special place in her heart, reserved for her Annie, her son, her hero. And so now, as it seemed the end of her life was imminent, Shmi's thoughts focused on those memories she had of Anakin, while at the same time, she reached out to him with her heart. He was always different with such feelings, always so attuned to that mysterious force. The Jedi who had come to Tatooine had seen it in him clearly. Perhaps then Annie would feel her love for him now. She needed that, needed to complete the cycle, to let her son recognize that through it all, through the missing years and the great distances between them, she had loved him unconditionally and had thought of him constantly. Annie was her comfort, her place to hide from the pain the Tuskens had and were exacting upon her battered body. Every day, they came in and tortured her a bit more, prodding her with sharp spears, or beating her with the blunt shafts and the short whips. It was more than a desire to inflict pain, Shmi realized, though she didn't speak their croaking language. This was the Tusken way of measuring their enemies, and from the nods and the tone of their voices, she realized that her resilience had impressed them. They didn't know that her resilience was wrought of a mother's love. Without the memories of Annie, and the hope that he would feel her love for him, she would surely have given up long ago and allowed herself to die. Under the pale light of a full moon, Anakin Skywalker pulled the speeder bike to the ridge of a high dune and peered across the desert wastes of Tatooine. Not too far below him, he saw an encampment spread about a small oasis, and he knew at once, even before spotting a figure, that it was a Tusken camp. He could sense his mother down there, could feel her pain. He crept closer, studying the straw and skin huts for any anomalies that might clue him in to their respective purposes. One especially sturdy hut, at the edge of the oasis, caught and held his attention. It seemed less tended than the others, yet more solidly constructed. As he came around a bit more, he grew even more intrigued, noting that only one hut was guarded, by a pair of Tuskens flanking the entrance.
"Oh, Mom,"
Anakin whispered. Silent as a shadow, the Padawan slipped through the encampment, moving hut to hut, flat against walls, and belly crawling across open spaces, working his way gradually toward the hut he felt held his mother. He came against its side at last and put his hands against the soft skin wall, feeling the emotions and pain of the person within. A quick glance around the front showed him the two Tuscan guards, sitting a short distance in front of the door. Anakin drew and ignited his lightsaber, then crouched low, shielding the glow as much as he could. He slid the energy blade through the wall and easily cut the material away. Then, without even pausing to see if any Tuskens were inside, he crawled through.
"Mom," he breathed again, and his legs weakened beneath him. The room was lit by dozens of candles and by a shaft of pale moonlight, streaming through a hole in the roof, illuminating the figure of Shmi, tied, facing against a rack to the side of the tent. Her arms were outstretched, bound at bloodied wrists, and her face, when she turned to the side, showed the weeks of beatings. Anakin quickly cut her free and gently lowered her from the perch, into his arms, and then down to the floor.
"Mom. Mom. Mom,"
he whispered softly. Anakin knew that she was alive, though she did not immediately respond and had come down so pitifully limp. He could feel her in the Force, though she was a thin, thin sensation. He cradled her head and kept repeating her name softly, and finally, Shmi's eyelids fluttered open as much as she could manage through the swelling and dried blood.
"Annie,"
she whispered back. He could feel her wheezing as she tried to speak, and knew that many of her ribs had been crushed.
"Annie, is it you?"
Gradually, her eyes began to focus upon him, and he could see a thin smile of recognition coming to her battered face.
"I'm here, Mom," he told her. "You're safe now. Hang on. I'm going to get you out of here."
"Annie. Annie,"
Shmi replied, and she tilted her head, the way she often had when Anakin was a boy, seeming quite amused by him.
"You look so handsome."
"Save your strength, Mom," he said, trying to calm her. "We've got to get away from here."
"My son," Shmi went on, and she seemed to be in a different place than Anakin, a safer place. "My grown-up son, I knew you'd come back to me. I knew it all along."
Anakin tried again to tell her to lie still and save her strength, but the words simply wouldn't come out of his mouth.
"I'm so proud of you, Annie. So proud. I missed you so much."
"I missed you too, Mom, but we can talk later."
"Now I am complete,"
Shmi announced then, and she looked straight up, past Anakin, past the hole in the ceiling, to the shining moon, it seemed. Somewhere deep inside, Anakin understood.
"Just stay with me, Mom," he pleaded, and he had to work very hard to keep the desperation out of his voice. "I'm going to make you well again. Everything's going to be fine. Fine."
"I love,"
Shmi started to say, but then she went very still, and Anakin saw the light leave her eyes. Anakin could hardly draw his breath. Wide-eyed with disbelief, he lifted Shmi to his breast and rocked her there for a long time.
"She couldn't be gone. She just couldn't."
He pulled her back again, staring into her eyes, silently pleading with her to answer him. But there was no light there, no flicker of life. He hugged her close, rocking her. Then he laid her back to the floor and gently closed her eyes. Anakin didn't know what to do. He sat motionless, staring at his dead mother, then looked up
his blue eyes blazing with hatred and rage. He replayed all of the recent events of his life in his head, wondering what he might have done differently, done better to keep Shmi alive. He should never have left her here in the first place, he realized. Should never have let Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan take him away from Tatooine without bringing his mother along as well. She said she was proud of him, but how could he deserve her pride if he could not even save her? He wanted Shmi to be proud of him, wanted to tell his mom all about the things that had come into his life, his Jedi training, all the good work he had already done, and most of all, about Padme. Oh, how he wanted his mom to get to know Padme. She would have loved her. How could she not? And Padme would have loved her. Now, what was he going to do? The minutes slipped past, and Anakin just sat there, immobilized by his confusion, by a budding rage, and the most profound sense of emptiness he had ever known. Only when the pale light began to grow around him, making the low-burning candle seem even thinner, did he even remember where he was. He looked about, wondering how he might get his mother's body out of there, for he certainly wasn't going to leave it to the Tusken Raiders. He could hardly move, though. There seemed a profound pointlessness to it all, a series of motions without meaning. At that time, the only meaning, the only purpose that Anakin could fathom was that of the rage building within him, an anger at losing someone he did not wish to give up. Some small part of him warned him not to give in to that anger, warned him that such emotions were of the dark side. Then he looked at Shmi lying there so still, seeming at peace but covered with the clear evidence of all the pain that had been inflicted upon her poor body these last days. The Jedi Padawan climbed to his feet and took up his lightsaber, then boldly strode through the door. The two Tusken guards gave a yelp and lifted their staves, rushing for him. But the blue glowing blade ignited, and in a flash of killing light, Anakin took them down, left and right. The rage was not sated. Deep in his meditations, peering through the dark side, Master Yoda felt a sudden surge of anger, of outrage beyond control. The diminutive master's eyes popped open wide at the overwhelming strength of that rage. And then he heard a voice, a familiar voice, crying,
"No! No, Anakin! No! Don't! No!"
It was Qui-Gon. Yoda knew that it was Qui-Gon. But Qui-Gon was dead, had become one with the Force. One could not retain consciousness and sense of self in that state. One could not speak from beyond the grave. But Yoda had heard the ghostly call, and in his deep meditative state, his thoughts focused as precisely as they had ever been, the Jedi Master knew that he had not been mistaken. He wanted to focus on that then, perhaps to try to follow that call back to the ghostly source, but he could not, overwhelmed again by the surge of rage and pain and power. He made a noise and lurched forward, then came out of his trance, as his door opened and Mace Windu rushed in.
"What is it?" Mace asked.
"Pain. Suffering. Death. I fear something terrible has happened. Young Skywalker is in pain. Terrible pain."
He didn't tell Mace the rest of it. That somehow Anakin's rush of agony manifesting in the Force had tapped into the spirit of the dead Jedi Master who had discovered him. Too much was happening here. That disembodied familiar voice hung profoundly in Yoda's thoughts. For if it was true, if he had heard what he was sure he had heard. Anakin, too, had heard the voice of Qui-Gon, imploring him to restrain himself, to deny the rage. He hadn't recognized it, though, for he was too full of pain and rage. He spotted a Tusken woman to the side, in front of another of the tents, carrying a pail of dirty water, and saw a Tusken child in the shadows of another nearby hut, staring at him with an incredulous expression. Then he was moving, though he was hardly aware of his actions,
His blade flashed and he ran on. The Tuscan woman screamed and was impaled. Now all the camp seemed in motion. Tuscans rushing out of every hut, many with weapons in hand. But Anakin was into the dance of death then. Into the energy of the Force. He leapt far and long, clearing one hut and coming down before another. His blade flashing even before he landed. Even before the two Tuscans recognized that he had jumped between them. A third came at him, thrusting forth a spear. But Anakin lifted an empty hand and set up a wall of Force energy, as solid as stone. Then he shoved out with that hand, and the Tuscan spearmen flew away, fully 30 meters, smashing through the wall of yet another hut. Anakin was often running, often leaping, his blade spinning left and right in a blur, every stab taking a Tuscan down, writhing to the ground, every slash putting a piece of a Tuscan on the ground. Soon, none were standing against him, all trying to flee. But Anakin would have none of that. He saw one group rush into a hut and reached out across the way to a large boulder in the distance. It flew to his call, soaring across the sand, smashing one fleeing Tuscan down and flying on. Anakin dropped it on the hut full of Tuscans, crushing them all. And then he was running, his strides enhanced by the Force, overcoming the fleeing creatures, slaughtering them, every one. He didn't feel empty any longer. He felt a surge of energy and strength beyond anything he had ever known. Felt full of the Force, full of power, full of life. And then it was over. Suddenly, it seemed. And Anakin stood among the ruins of the encampment. Dozens and dozens of dead Tuscan raiders all about him. And only a single hut still standing. He put his lightsaber away and walked back to that hut, where he gently and reverently scooped his mother's body into his arms. Chapter 21.
"There," Padme announced, as she hoisted C-3PO back out of the oil bath. She had to fight hard to keep from giggling, for she had inadvertently lowered the droid too far, and now he was waving his arms about crazily, yelling that he was blind. Padme yanked him over to the side and found a cloth to wipe the excess oil off of his face. That done, she set the droid down on the floor and unhitched him.
"Better?" she asked.
"Oh, much better, Miss Padme."
C-3PO waved his arms about and seemed quite pleased.
"No itches?" Padme asked, inspecting her work.
"No itches,"
C-3PO confirmed.
"Well, good," she said with a smile.
But her smile faltered as she realized that she was done. She had used her work with the droid to shield her from her fears over the last hours. She had hardly even realized that the sun had risen. And now those fears for Anakin were already coming back to her. She was running out of places to hide.
"Oh, Miss Padme, thank you, thank you," said C-3PO.
He came forward, his arms outstretched to hug her, but then he moved back suddenly, seeming to remember himself and his sudden lack of protocol.
"Thank you,"
he said again, with a little more dignity.
"Thank you very much."
Owen Lars entered the garage area.
"Well, there you are," he said to Padme. "We've been looking all over for you."
"I was out here all the time, giving 3PO a much-needed bath."
"Well, Padme," Owen said, and when she turned to regard him, Padme saw that he was grinning widely.
"I'm returning this droid to Anakin. I know that's what my mom would want."
Padme smiled and nodded.
"He's back! He's back!"
came Beru's call from outside the garage. Smiles gone, Padme and Owen turned and rushed out. They caught up with Beru outside, and Kleeg soon joined them, his hoverchair banging and clunking against furniture and doorways as he glided out of the house.
"Where?"
Padme asked. Beru pointed across the desert. Squinting and shielding her eyes from the glare of the suns, Padme finally marked the black dot that was Anakin rushing toward them. As the speck grew into a distinguishable form,
She realized that he was not alone, that there was someone tied over the back of the speeder.
Oh, Shmi, Klieg Lars said breathlessly.
He was trembling visibly. Baru sniffled and struggled to keep from sobbing. Owen stood beside her, his hand draped over her shoulders, and when Padme looked over at them, she noticed a tear sliding down Owen's cheek. Anakin crossed into the compound a few moments later, pulling up short of the stunned group. Without a word, he dismounted and moved to unstrap his dead mother, lifting her and cradling her in his arms. He walked up to Klieg and paused there for a bit, two men sharing a moment of grief. Then, still without speaking, Anakin walked past the man and into the house. All that time, the thing that struck Padme the most was the look upon Anakin's face, an expression unlike anything she had ever seen on the Padawan. Part rage, part grief, part guilt, and part resignation. Even defeat. She knew that Anakin would need her, and soon. But she had no idea of what she might do for him.
There wasn't much talking in the Lars homestead the rest of that day. Everyone just went about their chores, any chores, obviously trying to avoid the outpouring of grief that they all knew would inevitably come. At work preparing a meal for Anakin, Padme was surprised when Baru came up to help her, and even more surprised when the woman started some small talk with her.
"What's it like there?" Baru asked. Padme looked at her curiously. "I'm sorry? On Naboo, what's it like?"
Padme could hardly even register the question, for her thoughts remained with Anakin. It took her a long time to respond, but finally she managed to say,
"Oh, it's very, very green, you know, with lots of water, and trees and plants everywhere. It's not like here at all."
She turned away as soon as she finished, and knew she was being a bit rude. But all she wanted was to be with Anakin, and so she started loading the food tray.
"I think I like it here better," Baru remarked.
"Maybe you'll come and see it someday," Padme said, more to be polite than anything else. But Baru answered seriously,
"I don't think so. I don't like to travel."
Padme picked up the tray and turned to go.
"Thanks, Baru," she said, with as much of a smile as she could muster.
She found Anakin standing at a workbench in the garage, working on a part from the speeder bike.
"I brought you something to eat."
Anakin glanced at her, but immediately went back to his work. She noted that he was exaggerating every movement, obviously frustrated, obviously distracted from the task at hand.
"The shifter broke," he explained too intently. "Life seems so much simpler when you're fixing things. I'm good at fixing things. I always was. But I..."
Finally, he slammed down the wrench he was using and just stood there, head bowed. Padme recognized that he was on the verge of collapse.
"Why did she have to die?"
he mouthed quietly. Padme slid the tray down on the workbench and moved behind him, putting her arms about his waist and resting her head comfortingly on his back.
"Why couldn't I save her?" Anakin asked. "I know I could have."
"Annie, you tried." She squeezed him a bit tighter. "Sometimes there are things no one can fix. You're not all-powerful." He stiffened at her words and pulled away from her suddenly, and angrily she realized.
"But I should be," he growled.
And then he looked at her, his face a mask of grim determination.
"And someday I will be."
"Anakin, don't say such things," Padme replied fearfully. But he didn't even seem to hear her.
"I'll be the most powerful Jedi ever," he railed on. "I promise you. I'll even learn to stop people from dying."
"Anakin,
it's all Obi-Wan's fault."
He stormed across the room and slammed his fist onto the workbench again, nearly dislodging the plate of food.
"He put me out of the way."
"To guard me," she said quietly.
"I should have been out with him, hunting the assassins. I'd have had them a long time ago and would have gotten here in time, and my mother would still be alive."
"You can't know.
He's jealous of me,
Anakin rambled on, paying no attention to her at all. He wasn't talking to her, she realized, but was just playing it all out verbally for himself. She could hardly believe what she was hearing.
He put me out of the way because he knows that I'm already more powerful than he is. He's holding me back!
He finished by picking up his wrench and throwing it across the garage, where it smashed against a far wall and clattered down among some spare parts.
Anakin, what's wrong?
She cried at him. Her volume and tone finally got his attention.
I just told you!
No! Padme yelled back at him.
No! What's really wrong? Really wrong?
Anakin just stared at her, and she knew that she was onto something. I know it hurts, Anakin, but this is more than that. What's really wrong? He just stared at her.
Annie.
His body seemed to shrink then, and slump forward just a bit.
I killed them,
he admitted. And if Padme hadn't run to him and grabbed him close, he would have fallen over.
I killed them all, he admitted. They're dead.
Every single one of them. He looked at her then, and it seemed to her as if he had suddenly returned to her from somewhere far, far away.
You did battle,
she started to reason. He ignored her.
Not just the men, he went on.
And the men are the only fighters among the Tuskens.
No, not just them.
The women and the children, too. His face contorted, as if he was teetering between anger and guilt.
They're like animals, he said suddenly, and I slaughtered them like animals. I hate them!
Padme sat back a bit, too stunned to respond. She knew that Anakin needed her to say something or do something, but she was paralyzed. He wasn't even looking at her. He was just staring off into the distance. But then he lowered his head and began to sob, his lean, strong shoulders shaking. Padme pulled him in and hugged him close, never wanting to let go. She still didn't know what to say.
Why do I hate them?
Anakin asked her.
Do you hate them? Or do you hate what they did to your mother? I hate them, he insisted.
And they earned your anger, Anakin. He looked up at her, his eyes wet with tears.
But it was more than that,
he started to say, and then he shook his head and buried his face against the softness of her breast. A moment later, he looked back up, his expression showing that he was determined to explain.
I didn't. I couldn't.
He held one hand up, outstretched, then clenched it into a fist.
I couldn't control myself, he admitted. I don't want to hate them. I know that there's no place for hatred, but I just can't forgive them.
To be angry is to be human, Padme assured him. To control your anger is to be a Jedi. Anakin was quick to reply, and he pulled away from her and stood up, turning to face the open door and the desert beyond. Padme was right there beside him, draping her arms about him.
Shh,
she said softly. She kissed him gently on the cheek.
You're human. No, I'm a Jedi. I know I'm better than this.
He looked at her directly, shaking his head.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. You're like everybody else, Padme said.
She tried to draw closer, but Anakin held himself back from her. He couldn't hold the pose of defiance for long, though, before he broke down again in sobs. Padme was there to hold him and rock him and tell him that everything would be all right. Obi-Wan Kenobi slumped back in the seat of his starfighter, shaking his head in frustration. It had taken him a long while to extract himself safely from the factory city, and when he had at last found his starfighter, he had thought the adventure over. But not so. The transmitter is working, he told R4, who tootled his agreement. But we're not receiving a return signal. Coruscant's too far. He spun to face the droid. Can you boost the power? The beeps that came back at him were not comforting. Okay, then we'll have to try something else. Obi-Wan looked around.